Welcome to Turning Season Podcast, bringing you heartening doses of active hope in this great turning toward life-honoring, life-sustaining ways of being human. I'm your host, Leilani Navar. I facilitate the work that reconnects. I practice acupuncture and dream work. I believe in the power of conversation, and I love talking with people who are participating in the great turning in their own unique way, hearing about what they do, why they do it, and how they are relating to these times we're in. This show is for you if you're aware of the crises going on right now, if you feel love for life on Earth, and if you care about cultivating ways of life we can believe in, making a life-honoring present even in the face of an uncertain future. Today's conversation is with Tim Corcoran, who runs Headwaters Outdoor School in Mount Shasta, California. Tim has been helping transform lives for 30 years by bringing children and adults to the camp there, teaching nature awareness, wilderness skills, and earth philosophy. He's written a new book called The Earth Caretaker Way, written with Julie Bettler, another longtime core presence at Headwaters. The Earth Caretaker Way will be coming out a bit after this episode does in March 2024. And for the first time, Tim is doing things like podcast interviews, and I'm so happy to bring his voice to you today. I want to note for you that we recorded this conversation in September 2023, so what was current in world events at that time is different than where we're at right now in March 2024. You'll hear about Headwaters Outdoor School, Tim's story of finding that land and founding the school, and you'll hear a lot about what it means to be an earth caretaker, including some practical ideas for how to move in that direction yourself. Everything Tim talks about is grounded in decades of experience with people from a variety of backgrounds and home environments who've come to stay with him at Headwaters and experienced the power of connecting deeply with nature. Tim also talks about connecting with the stories and traditions of our own earth caretaking ancestors, which Osprey Oriel Lake spoke beautifully about in episode 38 as well, and is a central part of the work we're doing at School for the Great Turning through the Tending the Bones program. I'm really glad to hear more and more conversation about how we all come from earth caretaking ancestors who had at some time life-honoring, life-sustaining ways. Tim traces his own connection to Earth People's philosophy to his Irish heritage, as taught to him by his uncle and grandfather. A little more about Tim's story before we jump in. He knew at 6 years old that the woods were his home, and at 17, he spent 4 months alone in the Canadian wilderness practicing earth living skills. He began a career teaching wildlife conservation in 1974. During this time, he learned how to communicate with the spirits of the animals he worked with, which enhanced his abilities to connect on an intimate level with them. He's worked at the Alberta Game Farm in Alberta, Canada, as an animal caretaker, the Crandon Park Zoo in Miami, Florida, as an animal relocation director, and Marine World Africa, USA, as a chimpanzee and elephant trainer. Fun fact, you may have glimpsed Tim before and his elephant in Star Wars, where he played a Tusken Raider on the back of his elephant costumed as a bantha. Tim created Headwaters Outdoor School in 1992 to realize his lifelong vision of sharing what he has learned from nature and to inspire people to discover their own personal relationship with nature. Tim is also an accomplished professional nature photographer and has published a series of nature photography books highlighting sacred places. Tim has recently founded the Earth Caretaker Way Movement, LLC, with the intention of uniting a global community of earth caretakers to save wild spaces and create wildlife refuge within every environment, including urban settings. He's running the Earth Caretaker Way Movement and Headwaters Outdoor School on an amazing refuge of wooded land in Mount Shasta, California, where he lives with his wife, Jean, and their pack of dogs. I've had the chance to spend time at Headwaters with my family, and we highly recommend it for the experience itself, and also because this reconnecting, re-enchanting, falling back in love with, and being fed by the more-than-human world is essential to the profound changes that we need right now if we want to co-create a society that's truly different, that doesn't keep chewing up, consuming, and polluting the rest of the ecosystem in the same self-destructive way, just with different technology. Tim is doing the literally on the ground work to bring us into the connection and the incredible satisfaction that can be found in nature. As soon as the Earth Caretaker Way book is available for purchase, I'll add that link to the show notes at turningseason.com/episode39. You'll also find links there to the website of Headwaters Outdoor School and links to some current offerings at School for the Great Turning, including an online group dedicated to helping you clarify and strengthen your own role in the Great Turning, and a couple of in-person Work That Reconnects immersions coming up this year in Ontario, Canada, and in Northern California. All right, enjoy this conversation with Tim Corcoran. Welcome, Tim. Thank you so much for joining me on Turning Season.
Happy to be here. Very excited. You're my first podcast I've ever done.
Oh, that is such an honor. I know it won't be the last. I know there's people all around who've had the blessing to hear from you in person, and now we get to share your voice with those who can't come meet you there on the mountain. So thank you for doing this.
You're very welcome. I'm excited.
So I'd love to open with these open sentences that come to us from Joanna Macy and the work that reconnects, and I'll invite you to finish this sentence however you're moved to. Some things I love about being alive on Earth are?
Well, I would say this morning I woke up and I got to walk down into my woods and jump into our creek. And I think it's some of the simplest things are often the most powerful. Like this morning, being able to sit in my creek and just soak it up and wake up to the day and then look at the incredible Mount Shasta and know that she's going to always be there. That's an incredible way to start a day. I also start my days, I always do a little bit of studying about what news and what's going on. And I like to be educated to what's going on in the world, particularly with the environment, but in all ways. And so starting the day is going to be very exciting. I can hear a lot of good news that gives me a lot of faith and hope in humans and people and what we're doing. But there's also a tremendous amount of sad news, and it's learning to kind of hold that the space for that, carry the pain and carry the weight of it and still get out there and make a difference in the world. So I love this earth. I love being alive. I love waking up every morning and just moving my eyes around and pulling my legs around a little bit and stretching and going, wow, I'm alive. I actually truly love being alive. And I don't say that in any strange way. It's to be human on this incredible planet Earth. There may be more somewhere, some way, but I can't imagine being in a better place.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. It's making me smile and feel my own delight in just being in this body as a part of this living planet. So thank you. And for the image of your creek and Mount Shasta too. And you started to turn this direction a little bit, but I want to walk more down that path with the second open sentence, which is, when I look around at what's happening in the world, what breaks my heart is?
Well, there's so many big things, but the thing that just first comes to my mind is I heard about I've been watching the news of what happened in Hawaii with the fire on Maui. And I saw a scene of a guy who they found who had been caught in the fire, and he laid down on the top of his dog and they both burned. And it just brought everything up for me of what's wrong in this world. And it also brought everything up about how amazing humans are, that we can love something so much like a dog and lay down to protect it like that and give our life up, you know. And there's all these feelings all together in me, good and bad, you know.
Yeah.
And that fire just represents really everything, that the mistakes that we're making right now and as humans. But I have so much faith that we can turn it around. And I truly do believe that.
Mm.
So there's so many big things, but that's the thing that just has been in my head the last few days, you know.
Yeah.
Just thinking about that and what it would have been like to go through that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. Mm. Well, opening up from there, I would like to invite you to share a little bit more about your world, and I know there are beloved dogs in your world and beloved creek and mountain, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about Headwaters Outdoor School. And if you'd like, I think it'd be great to hear a little glimpse of how you grew up and how you found your way to this way of life.
I knew from the time I was a kid, and I was raised in nature, really, really close to nature. One of my life dreams was always to have a piece of land to caretake, and to grow food on, and to actually, when I was 9 years old, I had this vision and to have a school. And I knew I wanted that one day. When I was growing up, my grandfather had a homestead. He was an Irishman, and he had a homestead in Ronan, Montana, a little town in Montana called Ronan. And in that town was in the middle of what was called the Flathead Native American Indian Reservation. It was a beautiful, it was near the Rocky Mountains, and the town was right in the middle of it. And as a kid there, I would spend summers there, you know, learning about how to care for animals and grow food in the homestead. And everybody knew everybody, and all the Native American people there knew me as a kid. They knew I loved nature, and I'd wander around and they'd look after me. And there was no fear. You'd go out the house in the morning and come back at night, and you were looked after, you know, and I'd fish and I'd hunt and I'd hike. And one day I was out hiking and I heard a noise, and I went, and I was looking through these bushes, and I saw three older Native American men, flatheads. And I didn't know it at the moment, but they were tending a fire for a sweat lodge. And I didn't even know what a sweat lodge was. And they saw me, and I got scared because I thought, oh, maybe I was spying on them. I was in trouble. But they invited me into their circle, and I sat with them while they built the fire, and they took me into a sweat lodge. And that was 10 years old. Get this. That was one of the things. One of the teachings in our school is we call them defining moments. Defining moments are moments in your life when the trajectory of your life can change for the good or the bad. If you take a moment with that moment and utilize it, bring it alive in your life and go forward. And so many defining moments we miss, but the beautiful thing is they keep coming. That moment when they took me into that sweat lodge was one of the defining moments of my life, the biggest of all. I knew then, I called it, when I left that lodge, and I spent a couple of summers with them after that, learning and sweating with them, I knew that my path in life was, they called it the sweat lodge way. I call it the earth way. It's where the earth was going to be the center of my life in every way, whatever I did. And from that day on, I've never been anything but a nature teacher and spent my life in nature. And as I was growing up, I always thought I was going to go to Canada or Alaska, some of the wilder places growing up that we would always hear about and read about. And I just knew it was going to come forth in my life at some point. And so I was living my life, and I got to about 35 years old or so, and I felt the call to go to Mount Shasta to find my land. It just happened one day. I just felt it in every part of my body. And Mount Shasta was the place, even though I'd always thought of Alaska and Canada, I knew it was going to be Mount Shasta. And maybe it was, I had a really good friend who lived up in Mount Shasta. And when I was 12 and a half years old, I did my rite of passage by becoming a man ceremony up on the mountain, Mount Shasta, with my one of my main mentors, a guy named Bo Almroth, who really raised me in nature. And so I felt the call, and so I decided to go. And we drove up to Mount Shasta, myself and a friend. I also had a wolf dog with me named Joseph, who I named after Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce people, because he could appear and disappear at will. And he was like my spiritual partner, this wolf dog. And so he came with me. One of my best friends came, and I met a really nice realtor. And we started traveling the back roads of the Mount Shasta area in Northern California looking, and I couldn't find a thing. I was getting frustrated. And then one day he gets a call, this realtor gets a call, and a piece of land just came up for sale right near where we were already driving on a four-wheel drive road. And we drove down the road and we got to the land. It was 32 acres. And I'm a person, I'm always looking for signs to make big decisions. And so I had my dog with me, and he was really good at reading signs. And we walk out onto the land, and the first thing that I just absolutely fell in love with, there was a beautiful view of Mount Shasta, and there was endless water everywhere I went. There were springs, there was creeks. And this one creek named Dale Creek, I walked up to it, and I was still looking for a sign. My dog, the wolf dog, was happy. My friends were happy. And I look, and I see something floating down the creek, and it's a center tail feather of a red-tailed hawk. And at the time, I was also a falconer, and I ran a wildlife rehabilitation unit in Santa Cruz that I had started called Native Animal Rescue. And so I took care of all the birds of prey, and I had a hawk that I'd had for 40 years. And when I saw that tail feather, and no bird, just that tail feather, I thought, this is the right thing to do, man. This is the right thing to do. And then I felt this presence, and I looked up in this giant tree, the cedar tree, and I saw this spiritual being. It's the only way I can put it. And I call him the Earth Keeper. And I looked up and he smiled at me, and I knew that we'd known each other before. I just knew it. And I looked at the realtor and I said, let's buy the land. And by the end of the day, I was the owner of the land, which has always seemed like a strange thing for me anyway, that a human being can actually own land. You know, that's a whole other subject. But I knew I really wasn't the owner. I was the caretaker, and it was going to direct my life from then on. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1990. And I had a good friend who was with me on that trip, a guy named Charlie Stormow, as a partner at the time. And one day we were sleeping out on the land in different places, and we both had this visionary dream that we were to start an outdoor school called Headwaters Outdoor School. And we were at the headwaters of Dale Creek on our land. And that morning we shared that at breakfast, and we started the school in 1992. The school was, I mean, there's so much to it, but it's basically about bringing people home again to the earth, teaching skills that bring people close in a personal way to nature, and helping people to be so connected that they'll take their lives and commit to working for, fighting for, connecting with the earth and all that she offers. So there's so much more I could say, but I'll stop right there and see what you think.
Well, I think it's an incredible story. Thank you for telling the story. And I just, even in it, I hear all the multi-layers, multi-dimensions at play here in bringing you to that place, and the countless number of lives that you've touched since 1992. I think for listeners, I just want to invite you to talk more about who has come. And I know that you mentioned doing a rite of passage when you were 12 and a half. And I know that rite of passage for young people is something you've been doing there. I know you have kids coming from really urban environments, as well as kids who might already be closer to nature, and adults as well. So maybe give us a little picture of what goes on there.
So the school's been around for, you know, going on 33 years, I think. So And actually, before that, I had another school called Pathfinders, and I've always taught about nature my whole life. And we started out, actually, with the school, mostly adults, which is fine. I've always, my vision was always, whoever shows up at my door, I'm going to teach them about nature, and it doesn't matter to me who it is, what age they are. And I really enjoyed that period. And then one day a teacher came up and did a vision quest, a 4-day vision quest, where she'd sit out in the woods for 4 days and four nights with no food, just water, and seek a vision for her life. And she had such a profound experience. And she was the director of what's called Waldorf schools. They're private schools for kids. And she went back and started speaking to her community about our headwaters. And before you know it, more and more and more kids were starting to come up to our school. And so we had this period in the middle years of our history where it was kind of a mix between adults and kids. And now it's kind of morphed into probably 85% kids and 15% adults. My wife Jean Sage started a foundation to help people come to the school. And she funded it, and I've had other friends fund it. I'm not a great fundraiser, but we've been able to probably gift to people who need money, probably $20,000 a year. If you add that up over 30 plus years, it's been good.
And yeah.
A lot of the people I end up giving help to are single moms who don't have financial help so that their kids could come. I had a group of farm workers come here 1 year for a week, and we had this incredible experience with them. Hardly any of them spoke English, but we just had the time of our lives. I had a group of Native American kids come from Northern Washington. I've had kids come from inner city Oakland. Quite a few have come. And to keep it as simple as possible, the first step for our school is teaching people how to connect again with the earth, and having a personal experience with the earth. One word, where truly your heart opens up and you take it in. Because I think if we're going to defend our earth and work for our earth in a good way, we first have to build a relationship up with her. And modern society has taken that away from many of us. Not in any like conscious way. It's just happened, right? It's all the stuff modern society offers, cell phones and getting busy with work and driving down roads and, you know, wearing big clothes. And we've done everything we can to push nature away. We even more often than not, most human beings seem to watch nature more on television than they do actually going out in it, right? So we try to inspire people to reconnect and in a way where they'll keep nature as a major part of their life going forward. And when that happens, I find it's absolutely transformational. I'll tell you one quick story. I had a woman I was working with in the early years, and I really liked her. And we were working so hard with her out in the woods, doing sits in trees and hikes and explorations and eating wild plants and getting in the water and soap tracking and things like that. But she wanted that deep personal connection, and she wasn't feeling it. And one day after working with her for a long time out in the woods, she came in and she was crying. And I thought, oh my gosh, what happened? And I asked her, I thought something happened where she hurt herself. And she said it finally happened. That moment happened when she didn't feel like she was outside looking at the earth, but that she was the earth itself. She was the tree. She was the deer. She was the water. There was no separation. And that was a life-changing moment that she claimed. And I call it reclaiming our birthright to be a child of the earth. And she had that moment. And that happens for a lot of people. And as a teacher, that's my dream to have that happen. Because from then on, your life's never the same. It's richer beyond words. So that's what we try to help teach people. And we do it through teaching them physical skills so they can actually go out in nature and feel safe and live off the land in a good way. And then we teach them connecting skills called nature awareness, where they have an appreciation for nature from a spiritual level to a scientific level and everything in between. And then we have the spiritual side of nature, which can be very personal and different for each person. And then we ask people to take on becoming an earth caretaker and committing their life to working for the earth. And that requires keeping that relationship strong. So one of my famous statements that somebody made a sticker. One of my students made a sticker of this, and I didn't even know it. And I thought it was kind of weird, but it's become so popular. It's called "Get off your butt, get out in the woods." it's kind of, people love it, right?
My son has that sticker on his water bottle. Yeah. I see it every day.
Yeah, the people put it on their kids' computers and things like that. And it's true. You just got to get out there. The greatest teacher of all is not me, not my school. It's the earth itself, the plants, the animals. Those are the real teachers, but we have to learn how to listen to them and remember how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that shift in identity that you were just talking about for the woman in your example story, but for so many people where we come home again to feeling like we're a part of this living world and a part of nature. I think that's the most powerful thing that allows us to actually change the way that we're thinking and living. So I know you have a new book that is just about to be published. Please tell us the whole title, and then I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you're hoping to help people learn, help facilitate, even beyond what you've just shared.
Well, this book is it's going to be one of the last big things I do in my life, and I've put 10 years into writing this book. I've had a tremendous amount of help from people on my staff and friends, and the book's called The Earth Caretaker Way: Reclaiming Our Life's Purpose by Walking Backwards into the Future and Remembering What We Already Know. And what I mean by that is our ancestors who lived with the earth, they already built the foundation of this book. They knew this. They lived with the earth. They had no choice. It was personal to them. And so we've forgotten that over the years, but that memory is in us because our grandfathers and our grandmothers, going back thousands upon thousands of years, that blood still flows in us. And it's a lot of times it's just as simple as going out, spending time in nature, and memories and connections start to flood back into us. And it, before you know it, you've got that deep connection. You've got that deep love. All of a sudden you see and you feel differently about the earth. So this book is, there's a few parts to it. The first part would be nature awareness. There's awaken your senses, communicate with nature, connect with plants and their elementals, tend a garden, build human animal relationships, be curious and play, have a sit spot. That's a really important one. Soak in the magic hours. Photograph nature. That's my art. Grok nature. And then we have part two, wilderness living skills, is master wilderness living skills, such as fire making and shelter building and things like that. Follow tracks. Conquer false fear. Get to know the dark. Get off the trail and seek adventure and climb mountains. And then there's the part three, is earth philosophy. And that's open your heart, go into the mystery, greet sacred moments, recognize power animals, honor elements as living beings, reverence for trees, pilgrimage to the wilderness, land holds energy, collect earth medicine, create nature art, call on your ancestors, and acknowledge death and grieving. And then the last part is a life of service, and this is becoming an earth caretaker, which I hope will become a worldwide movement. And yeah, I'm not thinking big, but saving our planet from ourselves. That's my dream. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that part, some of the chapters are follow the Scout Earth Caretaker Way, take rite of passage, vision quest, make kindness your way of life, manifest your dream life, educate yourself, gather community, seek mentors and be a mentor, nature as your teacher, nature as a healer, nature as a friend, live in gratitude, the Earth Caretaker Way movement, where do we go from here? And that's it. And the book's designed to be open on any page and be able to look at it and get something out of it, or to read it through and through and to keep it like as a reference. But I'm hoping it will actually start an international movement where people will take on the Earth Caretaker Way as their way of life. And the Earth Caretaker Way, it'll only enhance every other part of anybody's life, no matter what they do, even if it has nothing to do with nature, will only make your life better. One of the things I like to say, as a teacher, I've seen so many people come to my school and they're seeking a purpose for being alive on this earth, the reason they're here. And it's one of the great struggles so many people have. And it makes me sad sometimes because I've always known that since I was a kid. And this is a path anybody can take and have a purpose for their life instantaneously, working for our earth. Instantaneously, it gives you a reason to get up every morning and do something good for our planet, which in turn is good for every living being on it, including, of course, us. That's a really quick just talk on the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like you said, just the titles, the subjects and the titles of the chapters start to give us a feel of what it's all about being an earth caretaker. And I mean, from my perspective, that there is this worldwide movement that has many names that is about making that shift in identity for many of us raised in kind of dominant globalized Western culture. It's a remembering, like you said, that our ancestors had. And for many people around the world, it's a maintaining of cultures that have never lost that. And we call it in the work that reconnects community, the great turning, you know, Joanna Macy's phrase that there's this great turning toward life honoring, life sustaining ways of doing human society. And so I am excited to hear about this big contribution that you're bringing from your decades being an earth caretaker and really being intimate with your place where you are there and all the people that you've seen through this core transformation that they've gotten to go through. Because I know there's a lot of wisdom that's come to you through seeing how people actually change. Because that's, I think, at the heart of a lot of this is how do we actually change? How do we actually shift how we're experiencing ourselves and what our role and purpose is here? So it's a beautiful phrase as well, earth caretaker. And I know you said that the land where you are, you're not the owner, you're the caretaker. So I'm curious to ask you in your own life, and then maybe if you can think of some of your students who are living in really different environments from where you are, right? Maybe an apartment in a big city or something. What does it look like? What do you do there on a daily basis that embodies that earth caretaker role? And what do you see people in really different environments doing where they're being an earth caretaker?
Well, here, you know, we this facility is about teaching. So that's the main thing. But we have the land itself, the way we've built this camp is we have certain areas like part of our land is just kept completely wild. And part of earth caretaking is tending the forest and keeping it healthy, because a lot of the land, probably 95% of the land all over the West and all over the country has been logged or mined or something's been done to it by humans. So it's recovering. It's not, there's very little true old growth untouched land left. So our land has been through fires. It's been through logging. It's been through cattle ranching. So part of what we do is we work with the land to bring it back to its best health. And we do that by trimming trees, by planting different plants, by creating spaces, by helping meadows to stay meadows, by working along creeks and, you know, that kind of thing. And in that work, we really build a personal relationship with nature. So part of the land is that way. Then we have the camp where people come, and we have bark teepees, which are absolutely beautiful, made out of cedar bark. And we have beautiful art pieces on the land and made with nature, like labyrinths and things like that, tree climbing sits, things like that, where the land becomes a teacher for people, not only by its beauty, but by what it offers, where you can climb a tree or you can go get in a pool by the creek or something like that. And then we have our buildings, which we try to have beautiful all around our buildings. I've created what we call forest gardening. And it's where I've planted over, for example, over 80 fruit trees and probably another couple of hundred berry type bushes and things. And we have our organized garden where we grow food for the school. And then in the forest garden part, we're feeding the animals. So I actively feed birds really, really good food. Some of the animals come and they get the fruit off the trees. So the forest garden has now, in about 25 years I've been growing it, it's now maintaining it itself and creating its own environment. And that's like a forest garden gardener's dream, where trees start on their own and it's full of wildlife. There's probably more wildlife around our buildings than there even is in the woods. So it's a sign of a really healthy space.
Yeah, wow.
So that's kind of how we've laid the land out. here. One of the things you were asking about what people can do back home in cities and things, like, for an example, one of the things I'm really pushing in the new book is this idea of there's been a couple books written about it. We call it America's New National Parks. And it's where people in suburbia and in cities turn their front and backyards into sanctuaries for wildlife and thus for people too. So a lot of it's getting rid of our lawns, which have a strange background of why we even have lawns anyway, or letting them grow taller, not raking up the leaves. I actually just saw in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, a full-on article about why you shouldn't rake your leaves, because insects are one of the great species of animals that are in so much danger right now from global warming. And if you leave your leaves on your lawn, that's where a tremendous amount of the insects breed. So there was, and I saw this in the actual Wall Street Journal, there's a movement to let your lawn grow and to also take it and leave the leaves on it. Don't rake them. Let the animals have their breed there on the lawn. So it's starting to catch on, you know. And there's, I also saw there's a don't cut your grass movement. I saw that in a, I think, another international paper. So it's starting to catch on. And you can even take, like, if you live in a city, I remember once I lived in Santa Cruz on a second story of a condo, and I had a small deck. I turned that into a wildlife sanctuary. I fed hummingbirds. I had doves nest on there. I had, it was full of plants, and animals would come in and be on the plants, and I had a beautiful sit spot. So you can, we can take and transform cities and suburbs into these amazing places. And just, I know it's a big number, but if almost everybody did it in cities around the country, we'd have more land saved than all of our national parks together. It would be mind-blowing, and it would change the world forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
That's such a cool vision. I hadn't heard that phrase, the new national park. That's so cool.
Yeah, there's been a couple of really good books out, really good research on it. The other thing we're really trying to push is getting behind saving just as wild land, 50% of the earth. And just leaving it for nature, for people, for not to be mined, not to be logged, not to be built cities, built just wild land. And that's a huge movement happening right now. I'm pushing that one big time. Even our current president, Biden, is committed to saving 30% of the land of the United States. That's an incredible thing. And he just made a 1 million-acre national park off the Grand Canyon. It's the fifth national park he's made. And I've noticed the National Geographic's getting behind saving 50% of the land. And I recently read that some multi-zillionaire in Kansas, of all places, who made his fortune on the medical industry, has donated all his money working with Geographic to buy and save land as wild land. And it's, so what I'm saying here, it doesn't have to just be the governments doing it, making national parks and wilderness areas, which are amazing, but every individual can do it. Whether you save a 10-foot square piece of land, you turn it into nature in your front yard, or whether you save 1 million acres like Biden just did, or everything in between. And individual people can buy land and save it too. Like an example, I call it up here where I live in Mount Shasta. It's kind of a joke, but it's a serious joke. I call it the Tim Corcoran Informal Land Trust. This land along this creek called Dale Creek is incredibly special land for nature and wildlife because there's so much water and it's such a spiritual place. So I envisioned saving all of this land as wild early on when I first came here, but I didn't have the financial resources myself to do it. So a 40 acre came for sale next to me facing to the east. And I got four friends and they bought that with me as a partnership. Then another 40 came for sale to the north of me, and I bought that with a neighbor, and we just keep that wild, 40 acres. Then one of my apprentices' fathers bought another 40, and one of my apprentices' fathers and mother bought 160, and then another friend came up and bought 40. And recently, a woman who's a friend of mine who does workshops here with women, a 40 came up for sale, right, just one property from us. and she put it out to her community and was able to fundraise and just got that 40. So we have over 500 acres saved in the Tim Corcoran Informal Land Trust.
That's incredible.
And wow. So people can do it on any level that matters. On any level that matters. That's part of being an earth caretaker is wherever you are, make the world better by doing something to make the earth healthier for all living beings, which always ends up benefiting us, the human being.
Oh, that's so cool. I had no idea that you had that much land protected there from development.
And we're going for more.
Yeah. Awesome. I have a question for you about this idea of wild land and also land that we're caretaking. I've been learning more, as many people have. There have been a few books about it recently and lots of articles and voices of Indigenous people, you know, helping us understand that the idea of wild as untouched by humans is kind of a more modern myth. And these national parks that were established early on in the U.S., had been tended by the Indigenous peoples living there. And you're talking about all the wildlife that comes where you have your forest garden. And we know that fire danger, like up there in Northern California, is reduced by traditional ecological knowledge of Indigenous peoples, their burning practices and all this. And so I'm sort of, and also there's some incredible examples from the Amazon rainforest of how that forest is tended and cared for by the people of the place. So I'm curious about how you see our relationship with wild land as humans, as beneficial presences, right? That, you know, there's this thing that breaks my heart that people think, oh, the earth would be better off without us if only there were no humans. And there's a very different way of looking at that humans can play a life-enhancing role for the rest of the web of life, too. So as I hear you talking about taking care of the place where you are and also this idea of, you know, little places like my backyard, you know, being a sanctuary, what are your thoughts right now and feelings and experiences around humans caretaking what we might call wild or undeveloped places?
Well, that's a big question. I go back to our ancestors and, you know, in America, it would have been the Native Americans were the true earth caretakers from day one. And like all human beings, they weren't perfect. They overhunted and did things like that too. But they were true earth caretakers in that they loved the earth. And they also knew if they didn't care for the earth, they knew it on a spiritual level. They knew it on a physical level. They knew it on an intellectual level. If they didn't care for the earth, they were not going to be able to live. They were not going to have food. They were not going to have shelter. They were not going to have safety. You know, we have this illusion in the modern world because we can go to Costco that we've lost our connection. But imagine what would happen if all power went out and there was no internet and there was no stores open. What would people do, right? We'd instantly it'd be insanity, right? So the earth caretaker movement, really, it started with all of our ancestors wherever they lived. Like I'm Irish. I just recently had my test done and I was Irish and Viking. And so I have incredible ancestors, the Celts that lived back in Europe. And they were, I tell people that one thing to do is really start to look at who your ancestors were and where they lived and what part of the world. Because we all have people like the Native Americans that lived in North America, all over the world. There were earth people that lived. And it's really powerful to research your ancestry and connections and how did your people live and where did they live? It's really powerful to do that. And so earth caretaking in this country, one thing, this might be a little deviation from your question, but it just popped in my head, is one thing I think that helps is we need more healing. And I think one thing that we need to do in our country is to tell the truth about what happened to the Native American people that lived here first. It was one of the true most horrible genocides ever happened in the history of humans on the earth. It happened over 400 years. And it's not even really in the consciousness of young people anymore. And I think that we need to have like a national apology for this. Just a statement acknowledging that it happened. And then it creates a space for a healing. And that's never happened. And that's one of my dreams that will happen one day. I know that it started to happen a little bit in Australia with the Aboriginal people. The leader of that country a few years back made a national apology and just talked about what had happened. We can't change what happened, but we can go forward in a better way. But if we don't tell the truth, we can't go forward. So that's one dream I have that'll happen. And anytime I'm out in the woods on the wildlands, I always think about the native people that lived here first and how they would have done it and how the places they would have lived, the things they would have loved, et cetera. And then if I move forward a little bit, I get to this place where one of the most incredible things we created as far as wildland goes, which you started out your questions about, is in 1964, the United States created the Wilderness Act. It was led by a guy named Aldo Leopold, one of my nature heroes, a great writer, and talk about an earth caretaker. And him and a few other people created this idea of where we take the wild land that's left. And this is land that has no roads in it, no development of any kind. It's about as close to nature being wild as nature can be, and set that land aside, call them wilderness areas. And the idea was only people could go to visit, but not to change it physically in any way. And that passed in 64, and there's over 808 wilderness areas now in the United States. It's one of the great things. It's one of the things that gives me hope for humans that we would do that. And that's an idea of where the land is completely wild. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, throughout time, people have hunted in those places and fished in those places and made temporary shelters and things like that. But that would be truly wild land. And then you have everything in between, from healing land to cultivating land and everything else that's happening. And all of it could be done in a good, healthy way if we want to. If we have the drive to do it. But building that relationship with the earth, that is the first thing. I want people to be able to feel the earth's call for help on a physical level, on an emotional level, and an intellectual. And if you build your relationship with the earth, you're able to hear that call and then go to action. And often wild land, like wilderness areas, that is an incredible place for people to go out on hikes, pilgrimages, vision quests, to seek quiet time and find that earth caretaker in them.
Mm-hmm.
And come back into the crazy human world and make it happen.
Right. Right. Yeah. And there's so many different ways, so many different aspects to making it happen. But I'm really hearing that a big part of what you're offering to the earth and to this time is facilitating that experience for so many people. That discovery of their connection.
And when you said earlier about, you know, people, something about, should we be here?
Yeah.
A lot of people believe we should just be gone. I can remember growing up, I had an incredible group of friends in high school. I grew up in Sunnyvale, California, which is now the Silicon Valley. And back when I grew up there, it was orchards, forests, and creeks. And I had an incredible set of friends who loved nature. We all did, and we all backpacked and hiked and climbed trees and hunted and fished and you name it. And we used to sit around sometimes at night around fires, and we would, I know this sounds strange, and we would say, if you could push a button and eliminate humanity, would you do it to save our planet? Because we knew even then, and that's going back 50 years, we knew even then that the problem was human beings and how we were taking care or not taking care of the earth. And I never could push that button. And as I grew, I realized we are not a mistake. Human beings are supposed to be here. And we're as much a part of the earth as every other living being, and we're supposed to be here. But we're like, because of this incredible brain, which is also our worst nightmare sometimes, and our ability to do everything with our hands, and our intelligence, which I never look at us as being any smarter or better than any other being. We're just different. I think that's a really important teaching that we teach, is we're just different. But we do have our gifts. And right now, our gifts have gotten us into a lot of trouble, but they've also shown us a lot of good. And I sometimes think human beings were like, if you put a 10-year-old kid loose in a candy store, what would they do? They'd eat candy until they dropped, right? Like 10-year-old kids, we're coming into ourselves. And if we can grow into ourselves, there's no reason we can't be as good for the earth as the trees are for the earth, as the ocean is for the earth. We are the gift that can just keep on giving. But we're right in this critical stage now in human evolution where we're either going to get it and go forward in a beautiful way, or a lot of us are going to disappear from this earth and it won't be a pretty thing. And we're right on that edge right now. There's no way to deny it. But I have a lot of hope, and I'm working for us becoming earth caretakers and solidifying our place on the planet and going forward in a beautiful way. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but that's where I'm going.
Yeah, but let's work for that, whether we're going to get it or not. What better thing to be directing our energies towards? Yeah, I'm with you. So I want to ask you before we close just about maybe one or a couple of suggestions for people listening, invitations maybe. You mentioned the sit spot and you said, oh, this is really important. So I don't know if maybe you want to talk about a sit spot or anything else you might invite someone to do to start tending to that connection with the earth.
Sure. The things that come to mind are, a sit spot is a great one. I always tell people when they leave, you know, people often come to the school here, Headwaters, and they get so touched. And sometimes we have an apprentice program. So sometimes people will come here for 6 weeks, you know, so they really, really are able to sink into the earth with the teachings and the sacredness of this land. So by the time it's time for them to leave, it can become kind of terrifying. Like there's a lot of crying that happens, or stuff that, even though people love to go home to their families, their homes, they get scared to leave this place. Because part of what happens at our school is you learn how people used to live. It's like it kind of happens naturally. We recreate this community here where people are kind to each other. You know, we're all cooking together. We're all learning together. We have 6 dogs, which are a part of the school. And so we get to play with them. You get to climb trees when you want. You get to jump in the creek when you want. You get to smell flowers, eat wild plants. It's how we were meant to be. And that memory of how we were starts to come back. And then all of a sudden, it comes to the end of your 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 week time here, and you got to go back home, say to the city, and it can become quite terrifying for people and difficult and painful. So there is that happens. So how do you bring it back? I cannot tell you enough. I think one of the things that's damaging, particularly young people, but adults now, are these smartphones. They will not get off their phones. In order to be close to nature, you've got to put in the nature school business, we call it dirt time. You've got to get out in the woods. You can't get it from your phone. You can't get it from the TV, even though there's incredible documentaries about nature. Mind blowing. You have to go out in nature. It's simple as that. And that is something I'm seeing lost. The countless hours people spend on those phones, it's terrifying to me. So having a sit spot is a great way to start, where in your backyard, in a park where it's safe, near you, where depending on your living situation, create a little spot by a beautiful tree maybe, or plant a tree where you can sit, and it becomes a place you can write, you can do artwork, you can look at trees, disconnect, think about nature, build an altar there of beautiful things that you found in nature through some of your travels. And that's a place to connect, and it becomes your place. And each time you sit there, you go in deeper, get to know every plant, get to know every body of water, every insect, every lizard, every snake. Spend time looking, bringing your senses alive. You're smelling, tasting, touching, feeling all of your senses alive in that space. And it becomes personal and sacred to you. Go out on the walks, go exploring. And the more you can go with no time or destination, where you just go and you just hang out. Maybe you walk 10 feet, maybe you walk a mile. Spend time with trees, spend time with plants, sit by the ocean, by the creek. Just be. You don't always have to be doing. You can just be. What do you think trees do? They be. They're in one place. Spend time just being. Don't always be doing. And that'll start a lot of it. And then the other way to stay connected to nature deeply is become an earth caretaker. Wherever you live, get involved with doing things that make the earth healthier. Clean up creeks, clean up rivers, clean up beaches. If you're old enough to vote, vote for the earth. That's a huge one. Find local groups that volunteer your time to help, that do stuff for nature. Talk to your friends about it. Go out with them and clean up trails and things. Get involved. If you're part of the good, you'll feel better about yourself every day and your life will get better. But I cannot say enough, and I'll stop with this. Get out in the woods. It's the best place to be. And that, in the woods, I mean anywhere in nature, as much as you can.
Here, here.
Yes, here, here.
Perfect. Yes, let's do it. I'm looking out the window at the butterflies and the hummingbirds coming to this little tree we have that's adorned with purple flowers. I think it's called a sapphire showers tree. And ooh. I'm just thinking, I want to go sit out there listening to you. And there's definitely lizards to be seen out there too. So yeah, thank you.
Spend time with those beings. You know, people often walk by, for an example, they'll walk by and they'll see a lizard and then they'll just keep walking. Stop and spend a minute with it. You know, if it's okay, even hold it, but look at it and study it and appreciate it for a minute. We're always so busy being busy, we forget to do these simplest little things like watching a bee on a flower for a minute or so can be a life-changing thing.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Well, thank you, Tim. I'm excited to share the link to buy your book and the link to learn more about Headwaters with everybody. Is there anything else you want to say before we close our conversation?
Well, I just plant the seed. This book is, we would like everyone who possibly could to buy it and to tell their friends to buy it as gifts for people. It'd be an incredible gift. All the money for the book is going to go to the Earth Caretaker Way Foundation, which is going to support but getting more land saved, but educating on America's new national parks, which is creating front and backyards as wildlife sanctuaries and saving large tracts of land and small tracts of land and every other size tract of land all over the planet, and to hopefully create earth caretaker facilities like Headwaters all around the country and the world. So it'll go to a good cause, and maybe it'll ignite a fire in people to become earth caretakers. And I think there's this point when if enough people do something, then it just gets out into what we call the super consciousness, or we call it the spirit that moves through all things. And then it just, all of a sudden, people just wake up and think this way, even if they never even had anybody talk to them about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's my dream. So I really thank you for having me on this podcast. It's wonderful to know there's people like you out in the world making a difference.
Well, likewise, I'm so happy that you're out there doing what you do. And I'm excited about the Earth Caretaker Way. So let's do it.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with Tim Corcoran. I love to hear what you think. You can contact me through the contact page at turningseason.com. You'll find the show notes for this episode at turningseason.com/episode39, where I have the link to Headwaters Outdoor School's website, and I'll add the link to the Earth Caretaker Way book as soon as it's available. And you'll also find links to upcoming online and in-person events happening through School for the Great Turning. Until next time, thank you again for listening and for all the ways you play your part.